Could we really be living in a simulation? Pat Flynn is next. Hello and welcome to Focus, the Catholic Answers podcast for living, understanding, and defending your Catholic faith. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. And this week we welcome a new affiliate apologist to Catholic Answers. An affiliate apologist, someone who's going to work with us and help us do what we do. And we're very happy to have Pat Flynn taking on that role here at Catholic Answers. So we asked Pat a question that's really been bothering me. Is it possible that I am currently living inside of a computer? Well, you're probably hearing me through some kind of computer somewhere, but am I actually living in one? Is the me that I think of as me not the product of flesh and blood, but is that me the product of some computer program, possibly running in the basement of some advanced young man in a society that I will never see? Am I the product of something like that? This has become a serious question. The philosopher Nick Bostrom raised it in 2003 in what has become probably the most talked about philosophical paper of this century. It's just asked a simple question. Are you living in a computer simulation? Here's what Pat Flynn had to say. Pat Flynn, welcome to Focus. Thanks for being with us.
Cy, it is a pleasure to be here. Thanks so much for having me on.
Yeah, and it's nice to talk to you as an affiliate apologist of Catholic Answers. We've spoken before, but never in your role as an affiliate apologist. So thanks for bringing your voice to our efforts. I think it's a great marriage for us. I hope it is for you as well.
Yeah, what an honor, honestly, Cy. You know, as I myself journeyed to the Catholic faith, Catholic Answers played a significant role, answered a lot of important questions for me. So I hope that I can just give a little something in return.
We'll talk in a minute about your podcast, Philosophy for the People, because I want people to find that. But we pose the question to you now that the great Larry King posed to the smartest man in the world, Neil deGrasse Tyson. And yes. I know Neil deGrasse Tyson is the smartest man in the world because he tells everyone that. So that's not true. He doesn't actually tell everyone that. He just gives that impression. So you can ask Neil anything when he's on Larry King. And can I play you a little clip and then we'll talk about what he had to say?
Yeah, please. I always enjoy hearing Neil.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Like Mr. Musk thinks, are we living in simulation?
I find it hard to argue against that possibility.
Meaning.
You look at our computing power today, and you say, I have the power to program a world inside of a computer. Well, imagine in the future where you have even more power than that, and you can create characters that have, for example, free will, or their own perception of free will.
Wow. That would be power, computer power. This is one of the great services that Neil deGrasse Tyson makes, I think. He is very good at making a succinct and clear argument. And so, because he's often committed to arguments in favor of things that are completely wrong, he actually gives you an opportunity to, okay, it's not just amorphous. He has, in a very clear way, said the wrong thing that lots of people are thinking in less clear ways. So I thought that was very clear. What did you think of what he said?
It's a great summary of a very influential argument that first, I suppose, came into philosophical circles with a gentleman named Bostrom. I believe he was from Oxford, and he had this influential argument for the simulation hypothesis, and Neil gave a nice summary. But the idea is, look, there's sort of three possibilities. Either we'll never be advanced enough to we'll never have the technology where we'll be able to essentially generate the situation that Neil just talked about. That's possibility one. Two is we could get that technology, but for whatever reason, we won't really kind of put it into effect. Maybe ethical reasons, we'll say we should never do this. Or three, we will put it into effect, right?
Yeah.
And then it seems like if we put it into effect once, maybe we'll do it a bunch of times, maybe even infinitely many times. And then the idea is, well, if that's the case, that could actually happen, then just throw a dart, right? And I think Neil actually says this later on in the interview. Just throw a dart. And what are the chances that you either land into sort of the original world, call that base reality,
right,
or any of the infinitely many simulations out there, right? And this is supposed to freak you out probabilistically in the sense that, oh, shoot, it seems like if I just throw that dart, I'm probably living in a simulation right now.
Right.
And that's so what that's kind of the sketch of the argument. Yeah.
One of the clever things about Neil Bostrom's original argument is he actually put a percentage on it. He actually said, as a philosopher, I want to try to figure out what is the percentage chance we're living in a simulation. And I can't remember now what that percentage was, but it was a significant percentage. And I think he's gone up in the 20 years since that very influential article, Are We Living in a Simulation, was published. But okay, so here's the thing. This argument that Neil deGrasse Tyson is making sounds very similar to me to the article, to the argument where people say, well, there has to be other intelligent life in the universe. There has to be, because what are the chances we're the only one? In other words, it's all about probabilities, whether or not you get intelligent life. And it seems to me the probabilistic argument for intelligent life is itself a failed argument. It's not true. And if people would stop making that argument, then you could relax and you're not living in a simulation and you're not going to be killed by aliens.
Yeah, I mean, so much of it depends on your background assumption. So as we'll talk about moving forward, I mean, I just don't think it makes any sense. In fact, I think it's a strict metaphysical impossibility,
right,
to think that a computer, anything that's sort of purely physical, could generate beings like us, you know, beings with conscious awareness and rationality and freedom of the will and all that. We'll get there in a minute. But of course, if you think that's a sort of a strict metaphysical impossibility, then the probability that we're in a computer simulation is zero.
Exactly. Right.
It's nothing.
Exactly.
Right? It's only if you grant that assumption that you can then start to kind of like fall into these really radically skeptical scenarios. That's the first thing I want to point out about this computer simulation hypothesis, is that it's structurally really no different than any sort of globally skeptical scenario, right? And the funny thing is that kind of from Descartes on, every culture has sort of had its own unique radically skeptical situation.
Yeah.
So if you remember back to Descartes and his meditations, and in his first meditation, he gives you the barrage of skeptical arguments of, well, maybe everything that you think you experience, maybe everything that you think that you're thinking is actually the result of some demonic hallucination, right?
Right.
And this is different than the simulation hypothesis, because Descartes isn't entertaining this as a real possibility. He's actually using it as a method to try and get to some like foundation of knowledge that's incorrigible and incorruptible, that can't be doubted. And then he wanted to build back better, baby, right?
So the idea is you just doubt everything that can possibly be doubted and only say what you're absolutely certain of. And this way your knowledge will be grounded on a solid foundation of what I'm absolutely certain of.
Right. And then you build back up with valid arguments. And so Descartes is using doubt actually to try and get to certainty. Right.
Yeah,
that's what he's trying to do. Most have kind of thought that he failed in that. And I agree.
Yeah.
But there's parallels here, and we'll be able to tie this in. But the first point I wanted to make is that this is just a radically skeptical scenario, right? Because we're just asked to imagine that nothing is really as it seems. It's all fundamentally an illusion,
right?
Whether it's from a demon or some kid running a computer program in his parents' basement, it really makes no difference, right? It's still a globally skeptical scenario. Brain in a vat, demonic hallucination, simulation hypothesis. It's all sort of the same thing. It just kind of is situated in a different culture, right? We don't think about demons as much anymore. Now we think about computers, right? But it's the same thing.
Mm-hmm. And then there's quasi versions of this. Like people will say, well, the simulation hypothesis, that's just the Matrix. Well, actually, no, it's not just the Matrix. The Matrix is the idea that you have a physical body. It's just being fooled by machines. The simulation is you ain't got none of it. You're ones and zeros.
You're a complete digital entity, right? Yeah, there's no real you that was knocked unconscious and then plugged into a computer. This the one that we're dealing with here is, no, you are entirely generated by the computer.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, but there's extreme versions of this hyperbolic doubt, you know, like Descartes, and then the simulation hypothesis, which are similarly extreme. But then there's also modified versions like the movie Prometheus, like, well, we were created by another race that created us, and maybe that other race was created by another race that created them, and so you undermine the sense of the uniqueness of the human person. That's one of the consequences of this. But also, it's just It's just a way of doubting and adding doubt upon doubt upon doubt.
Right. So I want to say two things, or I want to kind of break this into two different ways of thinking about it, right? Because sometimes, and maybe, Sai, you've had this conversation before, you're out and about and things get philosophical and you start getting to kind of your core beliefs. And maybe you say to somebody that you believe in God, right? But then they say to you, you know what, man, for all we know, we're living in a simulation, right? And so sometimes this is presented sort of as an objection to theistic belief in a sense. And I just want to just flag that really quickly, because if this is presented as some sort of objection to the existence of God, I think it's irrelevant, right?
It has no effect on the question of whether or not God exists.
Right, because it can't be simulations all the way down. Definitely those would all be contingent reality is still crying out for that necessary self-explanatory explanation. So it'd be an odd scenario to run the traditional arguments for God from, but it wouldn't block the traditional arguments for God. Now, that somewhat ties into Descartes' considerations. He makes a different type of argument for God, but he wants to actually get the sort of certainty and the reliability of our faculties from God's goodness, right? He wants to say, well, God is perfectly good, so he's not going to kind of like put me in this radically skeptical scenario. I don't think that actually works, because clearly God does allow people to be deceived. I think we could say like probably God might not allow all of us to be like radically systematically deceived, but I don't think you're going to get the sort of certainty that Descartes was hoping for by just punting to God. However, you can say this, right? If you've already got sort of the God hypothesis, then we can certainly appeal to parsimony. Right, because clearly the simpler hypothesis, we have God and he created the real world, right? And philosopher James Anderson has a good response to this. He says that in terms of these different scenarios, right, we've got personal creator God and then we have the real world. That's hypothesis one. Hypothesis two is we have personal creator God. He permitted the construction of a massive computer simulation. We're part of that massive computer simulation, and we don't have experiences of the real world. Well, in terms of just like a general theory, that latter is far more complex. It has far more components that could go wrong.
Right.
So we can say at least probabilistically, other considerations equal, we should prefer that first hypothesis, right? We're very probably not living in that second hypothesis, the computer simulation one, right?
Right. Okay, so that's on probabilistic terms, but you say on metaphysical terms. That means you are certain, you have a moral, a philosophical certainty. You're willing to say, in other words, if someone says to you, Pat Flynn, are we living in a simulation? You're willing to say, no, we are not living in a simulation. Where do you come by that kind of certainty?
Yeah, I want to come by it in two ways. I want to come from an epistemological standpoint, which epistemology concerns our theories of knowledge, right? How do we know what we know? And then I want to come from the standpoint of philosophy of mind. And I want to make an argument that whatever else consciousness is, it's not reducible to physics. And if that's the case, then you're never going to get it from a computer simulation. The first point, the epistemological argument, actually ties back into these radically skeptical scenarios, right? And I think what we can argue is that the simulation hypothesis is absurd to the point of being self-defeating, that it's actually going to be irrational to believe, right? Now, why is this? Well, here's the thing, right? When we begin to doubt sort of the existence or the reality of the external world, we're using reason to cast doubt on sort of our cognitive powers, our cognitive faculties, including deep intuitions, right? We just have deep intuitions. Like the first time I told my wife, Sai, about the simulation hypothesis years ago, she said, that just sounds ridiculous to me. That's absurd. I don't like that, Patrick. So she said, I don't like that, Patrick. When she really doesn't like something, she used my name. I don't like that, Patrick.
Yeah.
And philosopher Thomas Reed would say that's her common sense, right? That's functioning properly. And the common sense isn't how we normally think of common sense. The common sense is sort of that sense that affirms to us the reliability of our other senses by deep intuition, mm-hmm. right? This deep seeming that something is the case, right? Just like it really seems that 2 + 2 = 4, it really seems like the external world is real. We all rely on these intuitions and seemings, right? And we actually have, if you think about it, we have an intuition that our intuitions are reliable, right?
Exactly.
And
right.
We have this.
And
deep
we have
intuition.
Reason to, because we ask right. questions about it. We answer the questions. We make those judgments, and we can keep coming to the conclusion. Well, yeah, that one proved out. I don't have to keep fussing over that. That one proved out.
Yeah. Now here's the key point, right? The problem is as soon as you begin to sort of doubt the reliability of your cognitive powers, reason is one of those cognitive powers, right? So you're really giving yourself reason to doubt reason itself, right? But then if you're doubting reason itself, you have no reason to take any argument seriously, let alone Bostrom's for the simulation hypothesis.
Right.
You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
Right? Like we need our cognitive powers to be reliable to entertain any sort of philosophical argument. And as soon as we start to sort of cast doubt on that, the idea is that the doubt is like utterly corrosive. It goes down and it even corrupts itself, right? Such that we can't even really see these radically or globally skeptical scenarios as something that could be affirmed rationally. It actually becomes irrational to believe because of that sort of self-corrupting doubt, right? So yeah, does that make sense, Cy? Mm-hmm.
It makes sense, and it brings up this, and I know this is a slightly off the point, but I do want to say this. We could have a motivated reason for wanting to diminish our reliance on reason. And that is to say, when I say, you know, we can't know anything for sure, then we really can't know right and wrong for sure. And I think all of us kind of like to have permission to do things that are wrong. And so, do you see what I'm saying? That I think there is actually, you're making a very well-reasoned argument, but I would just like to take a brief moment to say, why do we like to think that there's no rational explanation for things? We like to think that because that gets us off the hook morally. I think there's a great attraction to getting off the hook morally.
Yeah, I think there's some interesting psychological explanations behind all of that. And there's also the point that I want to make is sort of opposite of Descartes. We just can't begin the project of epistemology, answering what knowledge is and how we know things, by doubting everything, right? Because then we get stuck in these radically self-defeating skeptical scenarios. So what do we have to do instead? What we have to do instead is start from the position that all of our cognitive faculties, the powers that we have, are at least generally reliable, right? Or at least generally reliable, or they're innocent until proven guilty. Because we know we can go wrong, right? We can be deceived. We can get things wrong. But the only way we know we've gone wrong is because we rely on our cognitive faculties to make those corrections, right?
Yes.
So they can't be totally unreliable, right?
No, I want to give you an example of that. Our senses tell us that the sun rises. And so people will say, well, you trust your senses. If you just trusted your senses, then you would think that the sun rises. But we don't just trust our senses. We trust our senses to give us data that we can continue to ask questions about and get answers about. And that's how you get a person who says, well, it's looking like the sun rises, but actually the sun is not rising. The earth is turning. So I think the hyper suspicion of our sensory experience comes from the fact that often our sensory experience is illusory. But if we would just go one step further, we would say, but it's not so illusory that we never get to the truth. It allows us to continue to reason and ask questions, get answers, and come to the truth.
Right. And it's not that we were like way off, right? Our senses were telling us that things are moving. We just had the interpretation wrong of what's moving.
Well
right?
said. Yes. Very well said.
Yeah. One more point about the self-defeat problem, because what I proposed, I think, is a sort of a global solution to all skeptical scenarios. But I'm going to go back to James Anderson, who has some good writing on this before. And he proposes that the simulation hypothesis in particular has a special sort of self-defeat problem because it relies on scientific knowledge from a fake world. You see what I'm saying? Right. It relies on the knowledge we've gained from this world about how computers work, about evolutionary history.
But this world is not real.
But this is not real, so why should we think that applies in base reality?
Yeah,
you see that, right?
Exactly.
And I think that's a really neat that's definitely right, right? So it sort of invalidates itself, right?
Like, so if you know how computers work in a simulated world, that doesn't mean you know anything about how computers work in the real world. Therefore, your knowledge in a simulated world is utterly unreliable as to whether or not a computer can produce a simulation like that.
That's spot on. That's exactly it. Right.
All right. But you, the key thing that I think you get at, Pat, is that consciousness, as we experience, see, I thought it was so interesting that Neil deGrasse Tyson said, well, maybe you can create a creature in a computer with free will or the perception that it has free will. And, okay, but maybe you can is not at all interesting. Can you or not? And you know, and the answer is, well, right now you can't, Neil deGrasse Tyson. What makes you think that just an increase in computing power will eventually result in Tron? You know, eventually we're going to get to Tron. That's what seems to be the argument. Well, no, just because you can make a movie about something doesn't mean that it's real. Like, there are no elves. Well, I shouldn't say, I apologize to all of Ireland. There's probably elves. But do you see what I'm saying? Like, the argument is, well, our computing power is getting better and better. Eventually we'll be able to make conscious beings. Well, you've never done it. So how do you know you'll eventually be able to make conscious beings?
Yeah, there are some critical assumptions that are sort of operative here in this type of hypothesis, the simulation hypothesis. One is a sort of broad physicalism or materialism, right? That whatever else reality is, it's what sort of physics and chemistry tell us that reality is, right? And that whatever else we are, whatever else human beings are as conscious rational agents, is just the result of this sort of physical stuff that through enough time and through enough configurations, right, eventually started thinking and becoming self-reflective and stuff like that. So I want to jump off,
that's just a story. It's not an explanation of how anything happens. It's eventually, ooh, it just started thinking. Well, that doesn't explain to me how that happened.
Yeah, and then it's linked. So there's not just physicalism and materialism, but there's also certain philosophies of mind there, such as functionalism. And functionalism will say that whatever else the mind is, it's just what the brain does, right?
Yeah.
And then there's a sort of subset of functionalism known as computational theory of minds, which says, well, what the brain does is it computes. And I just want to say all that's false, right? Physicalism is false. Materialism is false. Functionalism is false. Computational theories of mind is false. And if you have reasons to reject these assumptions, you have reason to not be bothered by the simulation hypothesis at all. So let's just sketch a few considerations here that might be helpful to people. So if we start from a sort of physicalist paradigm, what we're supposed to believe is that the sort of fundamental constituents of reality, whatever we're made out of, and different physicalists have different commitments of what they are. Some think it's just fundamental particles like fermions and bosons. Others just leave it undefined. But they're agreed that whatever this stuff is, it's disparate. It's not sort of self-reflective. It's not conscious. It's not aware. It's not about anything. It's not directed towards anything.
Right.
And then what we're supposed to imagine, Cy, here's what we're supposed to imagine, is given enough time and given enough ways that this stuff could maybe be configured, it somehow, by magic, flips over into its complete qualitative opposite. It becomes a reality that's unified, that's about things, that's critically self-reflective, that's conscious, that's aware, that's rational.
It becomes something magic. That it's not.
That's magic, like, right? And the analogy I sometimes like to use is, imagine you just have a bunch of white Lego blocks and somebody says, okay, build a purple tower. And you say, I can't do that. And they say, well, here, I'll give you more Lego blocks. And you say, I still can't do it. Here, I'll give you more time. Yeah. You say, I still can't do it. You can give me infinite number of Lego blocks. You can give me infinite amount of time. I'm never going to get a purple tower from white Lego blocks. Switch the relevant things around. I think you see the fundamental problem of trying to get consciousness, beings like us, from a physicalist paradigm. And just using words, as philosophers do, like emergent, doesn't solve the problem.
No, it just makes you sound like you're saying something, but you didn't say anything.
It just relabels the mystery, right? Like, it doesn't solve anything, right? Just one of my, a philosopher I really like on this, David Bentley Hart, says, if you just go through a lot of the literature from sort of physicalist philosophers of mind, just replace the word emergent with magic, and you'll lose nothing in terms of explanation.
Yeah, right. You do that, right? You're using a word to say, well, a thing happens. We don't know what that thing is, but it happens. You know, So I think Hart is correct on that. You just replace it with the word magic, and then you've got it. So, okay. So maybe you should say something. Because what I hope is that we will engage in this video with some folks who believe or suspect that the simulation hypothesis is really a strong hypothesis. Right. Well, okay, so I think the first thing they might say to you is, Pat Flynn, look, if my brain is not producing my consciousness, what do you think consciousness is? Because your idea sounds like magic too.
Yeah, so first off, I'm not a reductionist. I'm not a physicalist. I'm broadly an Aristotelian. So I think that we just have a substantial form, right? And that we are physical beings, but we're physical beings with certain powers, and we have powers to think, right? And that's just not going to be something that a computer is. So I've got a paradigm. I've got a theory to make sense of consciousness, but it's not a reductionist theory. It's a theory that has aspects of top-down causation as much as bottom-up, and I think that's the worldview that you need to have, a sort of, not to be too technical, but a sort of substance or nature first worldview, if you're going to make sense of rational agency and conscious beings. And in fact, Cy, I have an article on Catholic Answers maybe we could link or point to, that's called, I forget what it's called, something about like physics isn't the full story or something, where I give an account of free will, but you could just apply what I detail in that article to how I think about consciousness as well, because these things are deeply, deeply linked. Mm-hmm. But I want to say just two more things in relation to that. One is that we've only like very briefly sketched one consideration challenging one of the assumptions helping to propel the simulation hypothesis. There's a ton more out there. And what I want to say is that if you have good arguments against these assumptions, physicalism, functionalism, computational theory of mind, I think there's decisive arguments out there that refute these positions, then it really is a metaphysical impossibility. However, I want to say this. If those are your assumptions, if that's your paradigm, you should be worried by the simulation hypothesis. This should keep you up at night, right?
Yeah, well, I'm sorry, because in that same interview, Neil deGrasse Tyson says it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether I'm living. And I think you challenge that on the it actually does matter. So go ahead, Pat.
Yeah, I mean, imagine that, right? Imagine that you have these assumptions and you encounter something like Bostrom's argument, and you say, oh yeah, probably I do live in a simulation. And that you entertain these thoughts that Tyson entertains that, it just might very well, even very probably be the case that what I am is the result of some hormonally unstable teenager mm-hmm. programming me up in his mom's basement. And then you think that doesn't make any difference? That's insane. How can you sleep at night, right? That anything about me or anything that could happen to me is the result of some hormonally unstable teenager programming in his mom's basement? I don't know. Maybe I did. The problem I want to suggest, Cy, is not that Tyson takes the simulation hypothesis seriously. It's that he doesn't take it seriously enough. And you know that he doesn't really believe this, because if he did, he wouldn't be able to just dismiss it, right? This is too significant, right? If we really thought we lived in a world like that, how could you not live with this constant crippling anxiety that your programmer isn't just going to suddenly transport you into a torture chamber to have your legs boiled in molten sulfur for 100 billion calendar years just because he's bored?
Right. Yeah. I hate molten sulfur.
Me too.
Okay. So I come back to this, that what would be the motivation for this? And I have to say, deGrasse Tyson's blasé attitude permits a moral promiscuity.
Yes.
I don't want to say that's the only reason he thinks that, because I don't think that. But I do think we have to check our own motivations. I mean, if I live in a world where God made me directly, that I'm not, it's not possible for me to exist and have the powers that I have, except for a direct intervention of God in my creation, I matter in a way that I don't matter if it's the bad kid from, you know, Toy Story 2 that's controlling me, you know, that I matter and my actions matter, and I have to attend to them in a way that I don't if that kid is my God.
Yeah, I certainly think that's right, Cy. I think the latter not only has severe implications that should give you a crippling anxiety, they're also nihilistic, right?
Yeah.
And that blasé attitude, you know, to me that is a sort of, if it's not an explicit nihilism, it's sort of a practical nihilism. It's a lived nihilism, right? It doesn't really matter. Yeah, that's really a nihilist speaking, even if he hasn't realized it yet, you know?
No, and if I were the kind of person that believed that, I think I would, you know, do everything. And this is me. I'm not accusing anyone else of this. If I believed that, if I had that kind of blasé nihilism that comes from this, then I would try to behave you know, in a way that makes me socially acceptable, but I wouldn't worry about what I actually do morally, because I would know it doesn't really matter. I put on the show because that makes it easy for me to get along. So can we have a society and when everyone's just faking it morally, no one actually believes that it matters? Because when no one's looking, I could do horrible things. It just doesn't matter.
Yeah, I agree. No, I don't think we could ever have a society like that. I would just say, fortunately, most people still operate according to that common sense. Right. So most people, and I would say even Tyson deep down does not believe this hypothesis. Right. He can sort of, you know, nominally entertain it on a talk show. But the way he lives his life and sort of like in the core of his being, he knows it's ridiculous. He knows it's false. He can't maybe articulate why. And that's where I actually like arguments like this. Right. Because they show like, hey, if you hold these assumptions, this should bother you. But we know, but we also know that this shouldn't bother us. Like, it just seems so frankly ridiculous, right? We have this incredible seeming that this is, that we are not in a simulation, right? So what's wrong with this argument? Well, what's wrong with this argument are those sort of assumptions that are just critically, that are just really built into it, that aren't argued for, at least in most of the primary papers putting this out, right? They are literally just assumed, right?
Yeah.
And so it gives you an opportunity, I would hope, to reflect more deeply on the nature of reality, what your worldview actually is, and find a position where you can make sense of those deep intuitions and seemings, right? Now, what's a good position with that? Well, God created us and he created all of our cognitive powers, including those deep intuitions, that there is, you know, that the world outside my head is real. It's not fake. It's not a simulation. And I'm warranted in believing that, not just because I have this deep seeming, but because it's true. Because that's actually the case, right?
Yes. And you just feel like I don't believe any of this simulation stuff. But when you affirm for me, Pat, that it's true, like, and then you have very good reason to believe it, there's a kind of peace that comes with that. And I can get on with other things. If I don't have this hyperbolic doubt that won't let anything be settled. It's really inhumane to live that way. It's really awful.
It's crippling. It's crippling. And in fact, just to share a personal note, when I was, in sort of my naturalist years, I mean, skepticism was a real struggle for me. I mean, skepticism was something, and not just moral skepticism, but really these even more radically skeptical scenarios were things that really caused me to make that critical turn back on a lot of my assumptions. And it wasn't the only consideration that brought me to theism, but these were points of constant disturbance to me, constant inner conflict and turmoil that eventually caused me over time to abandon a number of those assumptions and to see why they were false. So in that sense, you know, a lot of people don't take a lot of these scenarios seriously, again, because we have that deep intuition. It's hard for people to take them seriously. But I actually kind of like these thought experiments, yes, and these philosophical arguments. I think they can serve a useful purpose for, and hopefully we've highlighted what some of those might be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and maybe prompt the question, you know, fundamentally under this is the question, what am I? Because that's what we're getting at. Is it possible that I'm this kind of thing? Is it possible that I'm this kind of thing? And if you ask the question, what I am I, there are wonderful answers and solid, hard certainties you can settle on. You cannot drain the mystery out of what you are, but you can be very confident that some things are true and some things are false.
Right. Yes, absolutely. Even if we can't say exactly what we are in every particular respect, we can know definitely what we are not in other respects.
And we're not a simulation.
We're not a simulation. We're not just a collection of fundamental particles, right? We are rational animals. We're composites of form and matter. All that good stuff that would be too much to get into now, but it's there.
It would be, but give me. I'll close with this question, and then I do want to ask you about your podcast because I would like you to promote it a little bit because we need more clear thinking. I feel like there's a certain naive way a person might approach this, and they go, "Look, Neil deGrasse Tyson, first of all, is smarter than both of you." And he is a scientist of the first order. And you're referring to a guy that died almost 2,500 years ago as your debate. Like, Aristotle has been proven wrong. Modern science is how we know things. Why would you say Aristotle is right about what a human is, what a person is, and well, I don't think he would use the word person, but what a human is, and Neil deGrasse Tyson is wrong. Why would you do that, given he's way smarter than you, and he knows science way better than you, and science is the privileged way of knowing these things?
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's an implicit scientism at work there, isn't there, Sai, in that? Yeah. And there's also this assumption that just because somebody is really accomplished or really intelligent in one area, say the physical sciences or astronomy, that they automatically know what they're talking about in other areas, say philosophical or anthropology, metaphysics, philosophy of mind. And the truth is that just as different sciences have different methods and are distinct from one another, science and philosophy have different methods and are really distinct from one another. So just having competence in one area does not guarantee competence in another area. And in fact, we see this all the time with many specialists who are scientists. And because scientists have become something of a priestly class in society, right? I think this, I don't want to do too much armchair speculation, but I think it gets to the head of a lot of science popularizers, where they sort of frequently venture out of their lane. And it's fine to venture out of your lane as long as you sort of done your homework or you qualify with what you're saying is, hey, this isn't my normal area of research, but here's a working hypothesis.
Or you do so with curiosity, like not with a sense of now let me take my scientific knowledge and explain all the things you don't know, but let me come with this same curiosity I came when I went to science class to philosophy
class. Yeah, and I'm going to give you a bunch of pseudo-philosophical twaddle, right? And it's sort of under the guise of, well, I'm a scientist, so it must therefore be correct. And that's just horribly sloppy thinking. There's no guarantee that anybody, even the most significantly accomplished person in one area, is going to have anything significantly accurate to say in another area. You just have to be willing to roll up your sleeves and, you know, take it case by case. And so even if you want to say about Aristotle that, oh yeah, he was wrong on some of his scientific details here and there, doesn't mean he was wrong on his ethical theory, doesn't mean he was wrong on his metaphysics, doesn't mean he was wrong on his philosophical anthropology. These are distinct disciplines, distinct subject matters. They have distinct methodology. So one can be off on one and completely right on another. And I think broadly, Aristotle was fundamentally correct. And Aristotle would be if Aristotle were around today, I'm willing to put some money on it, right? He would gladly adopt many of the contemporary mainstream scientific theories, but he wouldn't be a physicalist, right?
Right.
He wouldn't be a materialist. He would not be, he would not hold to functionalism. I strongly suspect that. Can't be sure because he's gone now. God rest him. But of course, we do have this sort of incredible renaissance of neo-Aristotelian philosophy, many of whom are severely accomplished scientists who would fundamentally disagree with Dr. Tyson on a lot of these deeper philosophical issues.
All right, let me propose a possible law to you and see if you agree with it. A person is not the kind of thing that happens by chance. Therefore, you can never make a probabilistic argument about whether or not a person will come into being.
Yeah, no, I think that's fundamentally correct. Again, if you're making these probabilistic arguments, it depends on the launch pad. You know, like what are your assumptions, right? I mean, I just don't like what do we mean by chance? First off, what do we mean by chance? If by chance we mean the sort of intersection of causal lines,
yes, right,
that are themselves providentially ordained, well, that's different now, right?
Yes.
You see what I'm saying?
Well said, Sai? That.
That's
yes.
Different because then God can bring things about by chance, right?
Right.
But it's not completely random in the sense that, say, a lot of physicalists want us to think it's the case. Now, I think that type of randomness is, again, just a metaphysical impossibility. That's not the actual world. That's not even a possible world. So for me, it's hard to even entertain anything downstream from that because I just don't even think that's a legitimate starting point, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I love talking philosophy with smart people who can teach me stuff like that. Very, very well said there on the meaning of the word chance. Any chance you could tell us about philosophy for the people, your podcast?
I can, yeah. So fairly recently, I started a new podcast because I didn't have enough with my good friend, Dr. Jim Madden. He actually is a specialist in philosophy of mind. So he's much sharper on a number of these issues than I am, because that's not my specialty. And it's called Philosophy for the People. And that's just what we do. We bring philosophy to the people, Cy. And we do it obviously from a Catholic perspective, but we've done a number of series already. We did a 10-part series on Plato's Republic. Now we're going through Aristotle's Ethics. We're working on Aquinas's On the Principles of Nature. So we've got a lot of good stuff going on there, and people can subscribe to our YouTube channel, Philosophy for the People.
Philosophy for the People. And also, big news, Pat Flynn is also an apologetics associate with us here at Catholic Answers, a new position. And we're just so glad you are, Pat, as people can see why. We're just very, very blessed to have that association with you. So thank you, Pat Flynn.
My pleasure, Cy. Thank you.
Things like you and me cannot be created by things like computers. It's not possible. Pat Flynn says it's a metaphysical impossibility. That's as impossible as an impossible thing can get. But it's not easy to see that. It's not easy to see, well, what kind of creature you and I are. And it's not easy to talk about and to talk in convincing ways for modern people about what it would take to create something like you and me. What it takes, maybe it is evolution, maybe the instantaneous creation of our bodies out of dirt and mud or whatever. But what it certainly takes, in addition to however that part of our creation is accomplished, is divine power. Divine power working immediately, directly to create us. Otherwise, you are not going to get anything that can be called a person. So you're not living in a simulation. I think it's a very convincing argument, but it requires all kinds of other arguments. But those are arguments we make on other episodes of Focus, arguments about what it means to be a person, what it means to have a soul. So I hope you'll check out our other episodes. And if you'd like to communicate with us, shoot us an email, focus@catholic.com, focus@catholic.com. If you'd like to support us financially, we would appreciate it. Thank you for your support. Just go to givecatholic.com. If you're watching on YouTube, thanks, we're growing there. Maybe hit that little like button, it's a little bell, and that way you'll be notified when new episodes are available. And if you're listening on one of the podcast services, Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, or one of the others, please like and subscribe. That way you'll be notified when new episodes are available. Really excited about getting to work more with Pat Flynn. We've gotten to interview him before, but now he's part of the family. I hope you will check out his podcast at Philosophy for the People. And that'll do it for us. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Focus.